Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Platinum VIP Terminal. Experience private check-in, suites for relaxation, and then chauffeur-driven to your aircraft.
Good morning. Not long now, my pretties. You will get to lick the top of the pencil and put your tick on the ballot paper. And you can't say you didn't have the opportunity to get to know the two candidates. Debates and interviews coming at you from all sides.
It feels like there's a big interview or a big, huge debate with just two people every single day. Sometimes multiple times a day. That's what it feels like, doesn't it? Going over the same ground like a veritable JCB on a county council contract by the paid by the hour. You know, dig up the hole, fill in that hole, dig it up again, make some tape, dig the hole, nap time.
Oh, very cynical. But as we enter the final few days, which way the lean? This was the view on Tuesday from Irish Times political correspondent Ellen Coyne.
If people were to label this as a classic left-right contest, you're saying that would be incorrect almost, because it's the battle for the centre-left.
Yeah, and the first people who would tell you that would be people on the right who are blue in the face from saying that they feel that they have no candidate at all. And we've seen in the two opinion polls that we've had now that there is still a decent cohort of the electorate that haven't made their mind up. We're trying to predict now where that, I suppose, would you label it an anti-establishment vote is going to go. Do they disagree with Catherine Connolly enough on left-wing issues that they would back Heather Humphreys to kind of see her as representative of the status quo, somebody who's defining herself very much as being pro-EU, or do they dislike the government enough that they want to kind of give Fine Gael a kicking and row in behind Catherine Connolly as the anti-establishment candidate? It's really exciting and really difficult to predict, even with a week and a half left to go.
And yesterday, Catherine Connolly and Heather Humphreys were in a head-to-head on Morning Ireland. Here's political coverage editor Joe McGreely with this summary.
In the course of this latest debate, the candidates touched on their political records, their views on housing, immigration and uniting Ireland. Catherine Connolly said she had demonstrated responsibility all her life, although she was not in government, but hoped the movement around her will now shape a different republic. Heather Humphreys said she went into government and took tough decisions, not having the luxury of sitting in opposition talking about things. They clashed on housing. Heather Humphreys regretting the governments she was in did not get more houses built, Catherine Connolly saying the housing crisis was a consequence of government policy. Catherine Connolly said she wasn't aware of the militia or regime links of a man who escorted her group around a Palestinian refugee camp on a visit to Syria, while Heather Humphreys defended her dealings with the O'Farrell family, whose son was killed by a drunk driver in 2011. On asylum, Heather Humphreys said Ireland is a land of opportunity and workers are needed, but asylum seekers denied status need to be returned. Catherine Connolly said language that Ireland is full is disturbing and unacceptable. This time next week, voting in the presidential elections will be underway, and the remaining days of the campaign are now crucial for the candidates to make their case to the voters.
And a lot covered on that 45-minute debate. But this particular question caught the ear.
Seven references to God in the Constitution. Article 6 says that all powers of government, legislative, executive and judicial derive under God from the people. You're going to be asked to swear an oath in the presence of Almighty God when you become president. Catherine Connolly, do you believe in God?
I certainly believe in something bigger than me, and I respect the Constitution that refers to God, and I'll take a public and solemn vow to serve the welfare of the people of Ireland. I've no difficulty with that. God for me means somebody that's beyond us, that represents idealism, that represents perfection, that represents all the best that we strive for as a country.
How much are your beliefs shaped by your belief in God?
My belief is in a better society, and a society where we strive for fairness, for equality. All of those ideals are part of anybody's concept of a God, a God that's gracious. So we all have different concepts of what God is, and I think we all have to respect that.
Do you believe in God, Heather Humphreys?
Yes, I do believe in God, and indeed my faith has shaped my values in life.
In what way?
In terms of tolerance, in terms of respect, in terms of treating people as you would like to be treated yourself. So I do go to church, but I don't impose my views on anybody else. I think religion is a very private matter, but yes, I do believe in God.
from Morning Ireland yesterday. And if you're only getting your head into this election now, fret not. There's a lot to come, not least the primetime debate on Tuesday night, which I'm sure you'll be tuning in for.
What's your sense of the public engagement around the country?
Yeah, I rang several constituencies yesterday to get a sense of what's happening on the ground. For instance, up in Donegal, one observer said to me it was the quietest election since the foundation of the state in Donegal, which is a very political county. Other counties the same, very little engagement on the ground. Talking to one political activist in Kerry, for instance, they said they met a brother and sister. The sister said, "I didn't get my polling card. It might be a good election not to get my polling card for." And her brother chimed in, I have my polling card, but I wish I was like you. So again, we saw it in the poll yesterday, 49% of people saying that the two candidates don't represent them. But there is still a chunk still to play for, if you will.
The undecideds?
Well, 18% undecideds. Yeah. You have 5% voting for the riderless horse and Jim Gavin. You have those who say they will spoil the vote, 6%, which could lead to around 90,000 spoiled votes on rough calculations. And then you have a swathe as well who say that they will not vote at all. So that roughly 43% of votes there potentially in play if people can be convinced to come out. And the point being made by supporters in the Humphreys camp this morning, and again this might be very optimistic, that 49% of people made their mind up in the last week of the campaign in the general election. But again, there is perhaps wide dissatisfaction at the quantity of the field, the 1v1 dynamic, maybe voter fatigue. Mm-hmm. So how that plays out and a low turnout is predicted without doubt.
And this time next week, folks, well, boxes will be opened and counting begins. Meanwhile, over on Lyric.
Merciful hour. Oh, merciful hour.
Good morning,
Archie.
Are our mics up here?
Okay. The mic's up here, yes. Good morning, 2FM Breakfast crew.
We are 2FM Breakfast, Ross Carl and Ash. To come in today because during the week, we realised, we read something in the papers, you have never, ever won an award. Yeah. And that made disgraceful. Us disgraceful. Very upset.
Did it?
It did, because
but
it
it's
felt
fine.
Like...
No,
it's not fine. It's not fine. We're not having it.
You all have mustaches.
In RTE. Yep. So we decided things needed to change.
So we put it out, Marty, to the 2FM listeners, and we put a poll up on our Instagram, and we said...
You put a poll on your Instagram?
We did.
You're such a briar.
Yes. We said, what award should Marty be given?
Okay. This could be dangerous.
People were voting on the most voluptuous moustache in Ireland.
Well, I try.
Ireland's uncle... The Always Sunny Award, and the Award for Suit Commitment, because you are always impeccably dressed every single
suit
morning.
Commitment.
Yeah. As you are today?
I have it on today. Like I knew, but I didn't know.
Exactly.
So what happened?
Well, in order to pay you the respect you deserve, we also wore suits.
You all have suits on? Yes. That's just ludicrous. Were you in wardrobe? Are they my old suits?
And moustaches.
We're wearing for moustaches. For those most voluptuous moustaches. But those are not the...
Yours are very voluptuous.
Those were not the awards that you were... given.
Okay.
The most voted for award for Marty Whelan, his first ever
this
award,
be worrying.
Was the award
for
Ireland's Uncle 2024.
Oh, I'm humbled. Oh, look at him.
Because Marty, everyone would love you to be their uncle. You're cool, you're friendly, you're always sunny, and you have a great
mustache. I'm awfully glad. Well, thank you. The three of you are so good. And it must have taken minutes to put this together.
I'd say. We got you a tiny plaque because our budget couldn't stretch to a cup.
None of us. You can't spend any more than 50 quid, you know that.
Summer of 2023, we have to be very careful about these things.
Very true. I'm honoured, I'm humbled. There are no words.
Well,
there are no words.
The only words to say are, the nation loves you, Marty.
I'll go away with that.
You deserve this and you deserve every award.
That's lovely. Well, you're very kind. Thank you very much. I feel, as we say in Lyric often, I feel a nocturne coming on.
We don't know what that means.
I know you don't. At times, neither do I. So that's a great thing. Thank you so much. You're angels. Thank you so much.
Nothing like a studio invasion of a Friday. And on Thursday, with Oliver, the very wonderful Mary Black.
Come running. Forget. it's always been, and so it goes, to ponder his death and his life eternally.
Some voice and so many songs we know so well. She makes it sound so easy. She's now embarking on her Slán tour, and this Irish tour will be her last. Not her last performance, mind you, but she is going to take it a wee bit easier. She joined Oliver for something of a life and times, and talked about being born into a close-knit musical family that she seems to have only just survived.
All the siblings got on very nicely.
Well, we used to be murder, I suppose. I remember somebody, my brother was playing darts and I got a dart in my eye. That was one thing that happened. And then I attacked my brother with a knife
one time.
He
nearly destroyed a national treasure.
Yeah, scarred me for life. It was normal sibling, you know, carry on.
She grew up in Dublin's south inner city in Charlemagne Street. And while she would say that they were luckier than many of their neighbours, they were not rich. Not at all.
But you did face a bit of snobbery because of where you were from when you went to school, was it?
Yeah. I was the only one in Charlemagne Street that went to St. Louis, and it was just after it was made free education. So it was always a private school. So on the summer before I started school, my mother said, you're going to have to get a job to pay for this. They had indoor shoes and outdoor shoes and blazers and gabardines and all sorts of expensive things for my uniform. So I got a job in a Lucky Bag factory. I lied about my age. I said I was 14. I was only 13. And I worked that whole summer and brought home the money to pay for my uniform.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's a story in your memoir, wasn't there, that you weren't picked for a telly show in the choir because... You looked a bit shabby compared to
me. I think so, yeah. We hadn't even got running hot water. We didn't, you know, back then. So, you know, my mother had to hand wash everything and boil the kettle and the pots of water. So I suppose maybe I was a little bit shabbier than some people. But that was a programme with Bing Crosby, and I was so disappointed didn't get picked. Yeah, yeah. So I look back on that and think, oh, well, two fingers up. I got there in the end.
You did.
And she talked about the moment that she knew that her husband, Joe O'Reilly, might be the man for her.
We went to this match. We drove up to Navan, Dublin we're playing. And there was about three cars went up, you know, in a little convoy. And on halfway home, we went in for a drink. I can't even remember if they won or not. There was jokes going on, a big long table, and we're all having a couple of drinks. There was somebody said something funny, and across the table, Joe was laughing and I was laughing. And I felt something instant, just all of a sudden. And it was only afterwards I found out that he felt that too.
Go ahead.
It was like as if music was playing or something. It's hard to describe. I still remember very clearly.
You catch each other eye in the middle of
that
a laugh.
That was it. Just in a laugh. And
you just knew.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
And she talked about her career, and what a career. And in particular, No Frontiers, the song and the album that took her all around the world.
Actually, the Albert Hall is amazing because you're now a massive star. You play Albert Hall, you go home for a little bit. And
no, I went home.
Presumably
the next
you're
day.
Like Taylor Swift, surrounded by entourage and someone
no,
photos
a,
you.
A funny story happened that when I did the Royal Albert Hall two nights and came home the next day. And a funny thing about me when I've been away for a while, I want to get in and start making dinners and cleaning the house. And so I'm out cleaning. I noticed the windows are really filthy at the front. And I went out the front and I'm up on a chair and I'm cleaning the windows. And this fella drives by. He says, I've seen it all. He says, I was in the Royal Albert Hall the night before last and you were there in front of 5,000 people and now you're out cleaning your windows. He says, I've seen it all.
Is it? Yeah. That's the most Irish thing you'd come up.
Very down to earth. But as this texter puts it, Mary Black has been singing us through a whole lot of living.
Mary Black's music has accompanied me through tough economic times in the 1980s, romantic breakups, feeling homesick while living in the US and Australia. She has always represented the voice and call of home. Gormaí agat.
And that was just one of the many texts in. And of course, you can't talk to Mary Black without talking about a woman's heart. Massive.
Oh, I did five nights at the Point. I still say to Danny, you know, Danny, when you do five nights, you know, like...
This is Danny O'Reilly of the Crown.
Danny O'Reilly of the Crown is my son. Because he's some, you know, they were doing six or eight nights in the Olympia. And I said, when you do 11 or 12, you know, you know, then you'll have beaten me, you know. Sort of. But it did take off too. I mean, it's funny, at the time you don't really soak it in. So when you look back, it's kind of like saying, wow. But at the time I took everything in my stride.
Did like, you? What? Yeah. You okay, had kids and everything.
Moving on. Yeah, kids, other priorities as well, you know.
Those of us who were kind of young people around the 90s, were you different lyrics to that beautiful ethereal song? Were you aware of that?
Yeah, definitely, yeah, yeah. Ah, look, it still goes on, you know.
My arse is low. My arse is so low.
Beautiful.
I'm glad now. I've always wondered over the years, did they know?
Of course.
Does that ruin it?
As only a woman's arse can be.
We cannot let him ruin it. Let's purge that with the real thing. Sing it. You know you want to.
My heart is low. My heart is so low. As only a woman's heart can be. As only a woman's. As only a woman's. As only a woman's heart can know.
Mary Black. Back in a bit. Welcome back. The Enhanced Games, sport like you've never seen it before, because this competition will allow, nay encourage, the use of performance enhancing drugs.
TRT, HGH, EPO, they're the type of drugs that we might potentially be taking.
That's Irish swimmer Shane Ryan, who this week confirmed he will be taking part in the Games. He spoke to Cormac on Tuesday's Drive Time.
It's a controversial event, there's no question about it. You're a three-time Olympian. Shane, you've represented your country at the Olympics in Rio, in Tokyo and Paris, I think. So you've won two bronze medals, if I'm not mistaken, at the World Swimming Championships.
Yep.
Why are you deciding to take part in the Enhanced Games then?
Yeah, no, like, look, again, it is a very controversial kind of thing. But with the Enhanced Games, you know, they reached out to me as soon as it started. You know, and that was like, you know, I think about like just over a year ago, and you know, and I declined it at the time because, you know, like I was still representing Ireland. I was representing Ireland as a clean athlete. And, you know, as I, you know, came along, you know, I was just like, you know what? I'm stepping outside of swimming. Like I'm 31 years old. My body's starting to kind of go a little bit. If I try to go for the next Olympic Games, I'll be 34 years old. Mm-hmm. My shoulders and body would not probably hold up as well. So I had to take a step back, you know, and kind of reconsider. I'm like, all right, when I step out into the real world financially, like, what do I have? And, you know, and sadly, Olympic athletes do not get paid well at all.
Okay.
I was
so
living
to cut to the chase then, Shane, if I may, and I'm respecting your views here 100%.
Of course.
Is this a financial decision?
Yes, it is. It is a financial decision, but also at the same time, it's an opportunity for me to be part of something that's new and exciting at the same time.
In taking part, he has the possibility of making a lot of money. Each event will have a total prize purse of $500,000.
I was on €18,000 for, you know, a number of years and trying to, you know, compete and train, you know, 6 hours a day or 4 hours a day and try to have a job doing that, especially with swimming, is very, very difficult. But at the same time, like that's below minimum wage, and especially in Ireland. I was living in Dublin. I mean, I lived in Dublin for a very, very long time, representing Ireland mm-hmm. for over a decade, and sacrificed, you know, friends and families and stuff like that, missing weddings and just so much.
Well, the Enhanced Games are planned for Vegas next summer, and its backers include Peter Thiel and Donald Trump Jr. Cormac put this to him.
You are a role model, Jane, for an awful lot of people. You are.
Of course.
I mean, an awful lot of young people mm-hmm. excelling in swimming in Ireland, look to you with your record. The Olympic Federation of Ireland have released a statement after the announcement, after your announcement. They say, we are very disappointed to hear about Shane Ryan's decision. Do you feel you're throwing anything away here?
Yes, of course. I mean, I feel like I am throwing a little bit away, but at the same time, you know, I've done what I've done for Ireland and represented, and I'll always be grateful and honoured to be represented Ireland the way I have, you know. But yes, I was a role model for some things, but at the same time, like, we don't walk into that role, like, you know, like, sometimes it's just laid upon us, you know, for because of the support that we do. And I think I did a very good job in, you know, doing clinics around the country, trying to support the future, generation of Irish swimming and sport. But what I need to do now is actually put myself first.
And this was how the interview finished up.
Isn't it simply wrong ethically to do this?
It's not, because at the end of the day, you have to do what's best for yourself. And it's everyone will always have an opinion. But for me, you know, and when you go out to the real world and the swimming world, you know, take yourself outside of, there's a lot of people that do this. The stuff that we're going to be taking is all FDA approved stuff. It's the stuff that you can go to your doctor. Yeah. And if your testosterone's a bit low, it's safe. Like I always
Are you afraid of the impact it's going to have on your body?
There's always a chance that it could potentially affect it in the wrong way, but I'm willing to accept that choice and accept that consequence potentially if it does. But I know we already had two lads that have already done it. We have such an amazing staff here with years and years of experience on it, and we're doing this in a very safe manner.
Okay,
but
and there's no way back.
We're being transparent about it as well.
There's no way back here for you. This is a done deal.
Of course, and I want to push this on. That's why I've signed it, and that's why I'm continuing, and that's why I'm on the phone call with you right now to first educate people and understand, you know, let people understand exactly what we're doing.
Okay. Look, I don't know if I should be wishing you well. I really don't, but all I'll say is thank you for joining us, and I really appreciate it.
From Drive Time. Now, prepare to enter the realm of the supernatural. Ooh, cue chain rattling, flying Ouija boards, and general spookiness. Who doesn't love a bit of the occult? And the period between the two world wars saw it peaking. Holy Men of the Electromagnetic Age, a Forgotten History of the Occult, is a new book by Dr. Raphael Cormack from Durham University. He joined Miles to talk about miracle workers, clairvoyance, gurus, and mind readers. And it all starts in the 1840s in Hydesville, New York, with two girls, Kate and Maggie Fox.
My contention is that the occult, the modern occult as we know it, starts in this farmhouse in upstate New York when these two young girls start to hear these disembodied knockings on the wall of their farmhouse. And at first they're scared, but these knockings keep carrying on and on. And they learn to communicate with these knocks. And very quickly, they come to the conclusion that these knocks are actually not just something random. They are the spirit of someone who has died underneath the house. And then they start to be able to communicate with all kinds of other spirits too, other people in the world beyond. And within a year or two, they have created this movement called spiritualism, by which way, you know, we can communicate with various other people. And this movement spreads throughout the world very quickly. It doesn't only just take America, it takes most of Europe. And within a couple of years too, it's reached Syria and it's reached Iran and it's reached Cuba and all these different places too. And that is kind of, the beginning of a decades-long fascination with the occult in the modern world.
And if you're looking for something to blame, while you're listening to it.
And one of the things that these occultists always say is that they're not doing some kind of strange woo-woo, they're doing science, just a different kind of science than the one that most people know. And the comparison that they always make is with radio, this sense that when you listen to the radio, there are these hundreds of radio waves going through us, passing all around us, and there's music, there's voices, there's whatever it is you want, but we can't perceive it. And it's only through a device like an FM radio that you can actually pick up all of these waves. And they're saying, the cultists are saying, well, maybe lots of different things are like that too. Maybe death is like that. Maybe the world beyond the veil is like that. It's with us, but we can't quite sense it unless we get the right device or the right kind of science that allows us to sense it.
Oh, blame the radio, why don't you? But the next significant figure in our tour of occult figures you should know, Tara Bay, who took 1920s Paris by storm as a so-called Oriental missionary.
And does he have a brand? Does he have an image?
He very much has an image. He's the Fakir brand, which is the one that lots of people copy. He's dressed in these long white robes with a kind of a white headdress on, like a kind of Lawrence of Arabia or Rudolph Valentino. He's selling to people in Europe as a fantasy image of what the East is. He can use his mind to control his body and control something in the physical world around him. He can control his pulse with his mind. He can shut off his pain receptors so he will stab himself with various things and not feel any pain. He can also enter a kind of state of cataleptic sleep, which is a little bit like death, and have himself buried alive. And all of the sort of scientists of Paris are somewhat baffled by what's going on. Then slowly it becomes clear that his background is a little bit more complex, at least than he says. He claims to be an Egyptian fakir who has learnt the secrets of the Egyptian fakirs from his father, who was a fakir, and so forth. In fact, he was Armenian, born in Istanbul. His birth name is Krikor Kalfayan. And he is, rather than a fakir, he is actually an Armenian refugee.
And he does, as you might predict, fall from grace. But he was the original, and as such important for the many replicas he spawned. But as the interview finished, Miles put this question to Cormac, and it seems particularly apt for the times we live in.
Are there resonances today with these charismatic figures who I suppose are selling different brands of snake oil?
There are definitely references. I mean, what I kind of argue in the book is that the one place where you can really see the anxieties and fears as well as the hopes and dreams of an age is in the occult. What do we do if we want to look at what people are both worried about and what they want? Well, why not turn to the sort of wellness gurus and the cults of today and see, well, what do people want? They want, for one, as they always do, a simple solution to a difficult problem. But now they seem to want also to exchange a bit of money and be reassured that everything is going to be okay. And maybe, too, these big technological leaps that we're making, AI, for instance. Some people use AI to, you know, answer their exam questions for them. Other people are already using AI to try and contact the dead. I mean, yeah, to, you know, create a model of what your dearly departed uncle used to be like and then set up a chatbot and you can talk to him. I mean, people are doing this.
Extraordinary. Is there no end to the possible uses of AI?
From the History Show. And AI is indeed all over the shop, particularly if you're perusing your investment portfolio. Of course you are. But you might be nibbling at your fingertips as you wonder if the AI bubble might be about to burst. With Claire Peter Brown, Managing Director of Bagot Investment Partners.
Going back to what Jeff Bezos said, the sector is in the middle of a bubble. Is he right?
Yeah, he is right. So what we have to see, the Mag 7 stocks are Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Alphabet, Meta, Nvidia and Tesla.
They're the Magnificent Seven, are they?
They're the Magnificent Seven, okay, who are all heavily spending in the AI sector. As a weighting, they represent 35% of the US stock market, which has 500 stocks in it. And these seven are 35%. So their share price is reflecting a level of profitability that they're not going to achieve. And the reason they're not going to achieve is they don't have the energy to produce the technology that they need. The energy is not there. These things require massive levels of energy, and it's not there. The infrastructure is not there, and the energy is not there. So we've got a massive bubble of overhyped stocks that are going to correct at some stage, mm-hmm, right? Probably by about 25 to 30%. But it's not like the dot-com bubble. In the dot-com bubble,
why?
We had a load of stocks in the dot-com bubble that were hyped on the back of the internet, right? Now, when the internet came, it wasn't those stocks that made the money, right? It was the Googles. It was totally different set of companies that made the money from the internet, not those stocks. So a lot of those stocks went bust. Now, we're not suggesting for a minute that any one of these stocks are going bust because they're just so huge and they've got so much capital. But there's a huge question mark over where they're going to get the revenue from AI that these stocks are predicting. So it's unlikely to happen. They're even admitting it themselves. At the moment, we're still in a hype situation. Everyone wants to buy them. They're in everyone's pension. But they are going to correct.
And of course, if it affects the markets, it affects economies, it affects governments and pension funds, and ultimately hits us all. According to Brown, the smart money has now moved out of the US to Europe and Latin America.
We've seen the dollar fall 15% this year. Right now, a little bit of that is about Trump, a little bit about, you know, uncertainty about investing in the United States. But it's mainly about the major, major wealth pension fund managers, global wealth managers, who've invested in US tech for 12 years, hyped it up for the last three or four, are going, we're going elsewhere. So if you invest in the US this year, you'd be up 1.5% on the US stock market. You'd be up 3.5% on the tech stock market there. However, if you invest in Europe, you'd be up 16%. If you invest in Germany, you'd be up 18%. If you invested in the UK, you'd be up 19%. If you invested in Latin America, you'd be up 26%. Mm-hmm. If you invested in gold, you'd be up 30%. And if you invested in silver, you'd be up 26%. So the smart money is rebalancing their portfolios after a long time of let's all just invest in the US. Right. But that's over.
And it seems the US is, to use a technical term, in a bit of a pickle.
How deep are those concerns about the American economy?
The American economy, it's not an American economy issue. It's American debt issue. It's just refinancing the debt you owe,
so
which is incredible.
The debt problem is, again, completely separate from the economy and
yes,
how well the economy is doing. So the debt can be in an awful situation and the economy can roll on.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, it can. And the reason there isn't going to be a stock market crash of any note is that central banks have got used to printing money. They love it, right? So any kind of worry about credit or something like that, just print money. Mm-hmm. Right. So we don't see any possibility of a stock market, other than a correction in the Mag 7 stocks. We don't see any possibility of a stock market crash. But we do see a situation where the dollar could lose another 20 to 30% over the next 5 to 10 years, which is a huge impact on anyone in Ireland who's got a pension in the US stock market. And that's really the difficulty. Like 50% of all the dollars in existence have been printed in the last 5 years. That's an incredible stat. Mm-hmm. It's an incredible stat. And we're going to get a lot more of it. So the uncertainty around Trump, combined with the fact that we've massively overexposed ourselves to the US, and combined with the fact that they've got a huge problems selling this debt, all of those things combined have just turned global investment managers to say, look, there's value elsewhere.
And lest you were in any doubt,
investors don't have any moral compass, right? Mm-hmm. You just go where the money is.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. It is hard to go past a bit of Michael Harding, particularly at this time of year. He's written a book, Midwinter, A Journey Through a Season.
I love summer. I could tell you memories of like 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock of a summer's morning with the dregs of a bottle of wine down at the lake shore with the loved one, do you know?
Yeah.
We all have those beautiful moments, but they pass and we grow old and then it goes to winter. And you can have this thing, like my mother had it in her old age. It was awful, you know. You'd hear her saying, oh, I dread the winter.
So?
I dread the winter, right?
Literally 2 days after I read the book and thought it's good to be alive, right?
Yeah.
And I can time it. It was Wednesday morning. I woke up and looked out at the dark and thought, I can't do another one. I can't do another one of these.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I suppose your point is that we kind of have to... And then I thought, is it my resistance to the winter that is causing me the issue here? Like you're kind of saying accept, embrace, yeah?
I think so. I was walking in, by the way, to the studio this morning and all the chestnut trees are gone rusty. And all the beech trees are gone amber. And they're so beautiful. And everything about winter is beautiful. And the rain in Leitrim is beautiful. If you just stop having this baggage of what I love and what I hate, and just be there in that present moment, Marilyn Robinson, the American, great American novelist, she says, just pay attention. If you pay attention, you'll find your bliss. And I think I've found that so much in the winter in the past 5 or 6 years that I really had to write the book about it.
And all of this acceptance and appreciation can extend to every area of our lives, friends, family, neighbours, and even our enemies.
Everything we have perceptions of as negative could be beautiful. And most importantly, I think, the people that we think are wrong, the people we think have bad ideas, the people we think are the enemy,
yeah,
they're as beautiful as we are. They're as loving as we are. They're as compassionate to their cat and their pets and their children. There's no enemies. And that's what you get. If you start practicing this stuff about winter, it's like realizing that winter is a metaphor for your own life. You're going to get old. I'm 72. And when I started writing, for example, columns about Mullingar, I'd be going into, in the column, fictionally, I'd be going into shops, gala shops, looking for beautiful Polish women and romanticising about how I'd have a great life with them, right? Yeah. That was a kind of a young boyish narrative. But at 72, what have I left but the narrative of an old man, which is the wisdom to say everything is impermanent, everything passes. Your youth will pass, your childhood will pass, everything, even the pain will pass. Even depression, it will all pass. And so that sense of just letting go of all these attachments, and we get attached to negative things, we get attached to anger, and we get attached to, you know, hostility towards certain people. And you can liberate you from it. And one of the ways I do it, I'm not saying that anybody would do this, I'm only telling my story.
Yeah.
And my story in the past 4 or 5 winters has been an exquisite meditation just on the utter beauty of this darkness as it enfolds us. You know, it's like the end of life. And the mystery is, it enfolds us towards the 22nd of December, but your eye is on St. Bridget's Day. It's the mystery that even in death, don't be afraid, it will come light again. It will come beautiful again.
Yeah.
Michael Harding with Brendan. And if you're looking for a book to get you through the season or even something to watch, go for Leonard and Hungry Paul by Ronan Heshen. He joined Brendan Courtney to talk about its adaptation for the telly. Just don't expect a car chase.
Gentle is a word I would use about my experience of reading it. I really enjoyed it. It has kind of little bizarre twists in their characters and what they do as well, which are surprises along the way. But not, it's very gentle. And at the core of it seems to be kind of kindness.
Yeah, I think so. I think that was a big part of the book. When I started working on it, I'd been reflecting on the people who had made a difference in my life. You know, when I was growing up, and also at the time when I wrote it, which was about 2017, 2018, a bit like now, it just seemed like there was a lot of darkness gathering in the world. And I started to notice and think about the kind people in my life or the kind people I noticed in society and the sort of force for good they were and how often it's kind of hidden and in private. Because a lot of kindness, I think, is expressed in private, which is probably why we underestimate it. But anyone who goes through a difficult time will always sort of speak about the people who helped them. So I think it was just something worth celebrating. And quite often in literature or in TV, for that matter, they're not the kind of people who would have a starring role. You know, they're generally not dramatic. They're generally not charismatic. They're not the kind of people who push their way to the front. So I thought it was just nice to write about them.
Ah, lovely, normal, down-to-earth people. Not so much for the narrator of the TV show, though. Have a listen to this.
Julia Roberts, her narration is lovely because, you know, we all know she's a very good actor and we know, recognize her instantly on our screens. But I never appreciated what a good voice she has. Mm. You know, her delivery is so gentle and her emphasis and the tone is lovely. So just hearing her voice initially going, oh, that's Julia Roberts. And then forgetting it really because it just sits so seamlessly in the edit. So I hope people really like it. I felt really warm after watching it.
She does have a lovely voice. Hold on. I'm sorry, pardon. Julia Roberts? How did that happen?
Julia Roberts had emailed about
really
3 or 4 years ago, or my publisher got an email from her PA, and it was very American. So it was like, I'm Julia Roberts' PA. If you don't believe me, look me up on Google, you know, and saying that Julia had bought the book, she'd read the book. And it meant a lot to her. And she wanted to send me some sort of note or letter.
Wow. So that's how it happened, Ronan. You're being modest. She's a fan.
Yeah. Yeah, she just shows you she obviously is a reader, and because it's on, like, it is published in the US, but it's on a small enough publisher, so she obviously just goes to bookstores and just buys. So she'd read it, and then nothing happened, and myself and my publisher were saying, did that really happen? You know, did that really happen?
Did you Google that PA?
Yeah, actually, she is. We did look her up. But I did. I actually dug the email out of my inbox recently, and I was like, yeah, no, she's still working with Julie Roberts. And so my publisher mentioned it to the producers. Julia Roberts was in touch, and they were like, Julia Roberts? Wow. So they just got the email and just sent an email to the PA and said, you know this book you mentioned? We're actually making a TV show. Would Julia be interested in narrating? And she responded in 2 hours.
Wow.
She came back and said, yes, she wants to do it. So
that's amazing.
She had a very personal connection to the book. Yeah. Oh, it's crazy. Absolutely crazy, yeah.
Wow. Well, let's stay in the world of glamour, because on Arena on Monday, Grammy and Oscar winner Mark Ronson. Yes, he's a famed producer, but he started off as a DJ in New York in the 90s. And he's written about that club scene in his book, Night People. And he talked about playing at the Cheetah Club, where hip-hop ruled. But what happens if you decide to go rogue? Could go either way.
I was playing, and it wasn't even my gig. I had the guest. I was guesting in for a friend, and this was the biggest club in New York at the time. It was Mike Tyson, Janet Jackson, Aaliyah, Missy. Everybody went there, and I decided that I wanted to play AC/DC Back in Black. It's just an incredible song, and it's the kind of song that they never played anything like that at this club. And you could potentially, for playing the wrong song at this club, get, you know, an empty bottle of champagne thrown your way. Like, it was like, you didn't want to be messing around like that. And I certainly would have, like, never been asked to come back. I had this idea, and I worked out this mix to play like the biggest song of the moment, this Biggie song, into it. And I dropped it on beat, and there was a split second where the whole crowd kind of just like, look, but because it was on beat and the groove is so heavy in that song, and everybody was dancing, it took a second, and then the club kind of erupted and everyone went nuts dancing to this song. And it was such a thrilling moment, because it was a kind of big risk, and I was glad that I wasn't about to get killed for it, but also this idea that of going somewhere new and unexpected as a DJ. You know, it's, of course we want to keep people moving and you want to play songs people know, but you also want to set yourself out apart from everybody by doing things that not everybody's doing, or taking the crowd on a journey, or like a little bit of a lesson. So that was probably one of the mixes, and that from that point on I became known as, oh, he's the guy that like plays AC/DC and Led Zeppelin, the White Stripes mixed with hip hop. So it was a big moment for me in my career.
And all of that mixing and blending would come into play when he started producing records for the likes of Amy Winehouse and Miley Cyrus.
What do you think you took from that era of being a DJ then to your work as a producer later on?
I think it shaped probably 90% of everything I've ever done. You know, I think that as a DJ, those years, whether it was like watching the records that made the crowd move, or just all those countless hours digging for crates and studying records and learning about the arrangement of old disco and soul records, kind of shape everything, I think, in some ways. It becomes your lexicon, you know, like of your inventory of sounds and arrangements and ideas. But this whole era really shaped, and I think as a DJ, like the way putting AC/DC together with Chaka Khan and Biggie and these things, I think that's always been the way I've made music, and in some ways, maybe not sing so much genre, because as a DJ, you're like, well, these things, of course they can fit together because I've mixed them together before, you know?
Loving your work, sir. And that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. We are not with you next week. Bumped we are for the election count. But we leave you with this humdinger. This is that.
Michelle fight for that white gold. This one for them hood girls.